And you're listening to the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio. It's the second hour of the programme this morning. And this is Donal Kavanagh with you on till 12 midday, as the name of the show would suggest. Now, let's look at some of your comments before we go any further. Being at the match, caller says, we miss out on the Highland Radio commentary. My late mum used to love listening to Highland to keep her up to date on the games. Is it possible to listen back to the match as a podcast? Would love to savour that enjoyment. I know certainly on the Highland Radio webpage at the moment, you can certainly listen back to the immediate aftermath of the match, the conversation between Oisin, Brendan Kilcoyne and other guests. I was listening to that myself last night, actually. So that is certainly available on the podcast. There is so much else on the podcast as well. I'm not sure the entire match is being podcast. I'll certainly say that to Oisin, actually. It'd be very interesting to have the full match available to listen back to. Caller says, and this is just maybe a word of warning, and this can happen anywhere, my dad was pickpocketed at the match yesterday in Croke Park. Can you put out a wee word of warning, please? It had cash, his miraculous medal and his Padre Pio relic. So many great Donegal people were so kind to him on the bus after, and they made it the best of a bad situation. And I suppose that pickpocketing is a scourge and a problem everywhere, not just in Croke Park, but please always do be aware. Caller says, disgrace the price of tickets for the final. And then another caller saying, Highland Radio putting the blink on Donegal. We're in an All-Ireland final. What an achievement. Brilliant. Stop running away with yourselves. Let's do the talking after the final. I think in fairness, what we're talking about is the build-up to the final. I think we reflected a lot on the success yesterday and what a great game it was. And one of the biggest winning margins in an All-Ireland semi-final in history. I think that's worth commemorating. I think it's worth celebrating. Certainly we're approaching the final. I don't think anyone's making any presumptions, and no one is going to take Kerry for granted. Certainly not Oisin and the Highland Radio Sports Department. No one here is going to take Kerry for granted. But let's look forward with optimism. Now let's go back to the other topic we discussed in the first hour, and that was people blocking off the parking areas in front of the RNLI and Coast Guard stations in Donegal. Problems we heard about in Bundoran, and also problems in Mulroy in Downings. Caller says, can the Gardaí not be notified of this? Obstructing vehicles should be either clamped or named and shamed on social media, so says the caller. Should be an automatic tow-away and a €250 release fee. Shocking, says another caller. No excuse for it. It could be the people driving the cars that could be in difficulty in the water. Very good point. And they'd be the first to complain if the RNLI couldn't assist them. If I were a Gardaí, I would phone the recovery truck and impound such yokes and get them back a fine of at least €500. And each day that they're in the pound, an extra €200 per day. Again, caller says, no warning, just do it. What sort of brainless people would even consider blocking a lifeboat station? Caller says, the guards should have been rung and the cars impounded. Again, now, another caller. A caller says, this shows Donegal County Council needs to invest more in parking. That's why the yellow boxes are used for parking and access to the slipway is obstructed. It's not the people's fault. It's an issue with the council. I'm sorry, caller. I'm sorry. I don't often on this programme say you're wrong, but I'm sorry, in this instance, caller, you are wrong. There is no excuse for blocking an emergency service vehicle from getting to where it needs to be. The lifeboat needs to get onto the water. Cars parking on those yellow lines are blocking the path of a lifeboat that's necessary potentially to save lives. I am sorry, it's not the council's fault, it's the fault of the people who are parking there. No ifs, no buts, no excuses. And even if you have to park half a mile away, I am sorry, but that is not an excuse for blocking access to the water to the RNLI under any circumstances at all whatsoever. End of story. I'm sorry, but this is a no discussion issue. There is no excuse for blocking, and to try and blame it on Donegal County Council and take the responsibility away for those who are doing it, I'm sorry, it certainly doesn't wash with me. A waste of time taking photographs. Why don't the Gardaí give them a heavy fine or ring a recovery vehicle and get them lifted? Another caller again, are there no guards in Bundoran? Get the guards to tow them. Unbelievable, some people, very bad form to do that. Total disgrace for our rescue services. You need to show the reg, it's the only way they'll learn, unfortunately. Caller says, clamp them, bet they won't do it again. That's all well and good. Here's the problem. If you clamp them, you are blocking then even potentially even more permanently you're blocking the area. I mean, the idea is at the very least, you're going to have to get them out of the way as quickly as possible. Clamping, I'm not sure would be the answer. Towing, absolutely different story. It's a pity the RNLI don't have the authority to clamp them. Again, that's the problem with clamping. Clamping is one thing if it's a space on the side of a road, or if it's an overstay in a car park, or if it's somewhere that's not blocking something else. But if you clamp something that is blocking emergency access, the corollary of that is you're blocking that emergency access even more. Just a caller was saying, if there's anyone going to Ross Nowla today, I'm aware that some kids got stung yesterday. A lot of jellyfish about. Please keep an eye out in the water. That's certainly always good advice there. Please do take care in the water if you're going in and you're paddling. Now, caller says a young girl was waiting 6 months on a driving test, only for them to cancel this morning, 4 hours before the test happened. Now, obviously, we're not given the reason for the cancellation here. It could well be for reasons of illness or something like that. We don't know the ins and outs of that story. But to be waiting 6 months on a driving test and then to have the test cancelled at the last minute must be heartbreaking. I'm sure there is a reason for it. But that's difficult, to say the least, for the person who had to go through that. Now, it's 60 minutes past 10. We're going to take a short break. Back after these. And again, to remind you, if you want to take part in the programme, take part in the discussion, you can text or WhatsApp us on 086 60 25000. Call us on 074 91 25000. Donna Marie producing today, and Shannon taking calls as well. And by the way, belated happy birthday to Shannon. Great celebrations over the weekend. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Shannon. Happy birthday to you. And you can, of course, contact us via social media. We're Highland Hub on Facebook, at Highland Radio on Twitter, and we're on Instagram and Snapchat. You can, of course, watch us as well on our YouTube channel, Highland Radio Ireland, and we're also available to watch on our Facebook pages as well. I want to say hello to the people that are watching, Beth and Mel, Marie and Mary. Good morning and thank you all. And Marie in particular, or Mary, commenting on my shirt. Thank you very much indeed, Mary. When I had a midlife crisis, I decided I would celebrate my midlife crisis by playing ukulele and wearing Hawaiian shirts. To be honest, it's a lot cheaper than buying a Harley Davidson. This is the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio. Now, I want to go to line one, and we're joined by Deputy Charles Ward of the 100% Redress Party. Charles, very good morning to you.
Good morning, Donald. Good morning to all the listeners.
Charles, you obviously are looking at the situation in Donegal first and foremost. You're a Donegal TD, but you're obviously keeping a watching brief on what's happening with regards to defective blocks across the country. And testing has been carried out now in 26 counties on this island. And you believe that we've always said that what was happening in Donegal was the tip of the iceberg, and there was a lot more to be uncovered and a lot more to be unveiled. We're starting to actually see that come to pass.
Yeah, definitely. We know 26 counties at the moment have tested positive for defective concrete. I myself have been to 29 and seen what I would consider to be defective concrete, but you can't consider it till I've actually said it to the people, till you get the test. So it's slowly but surely coming into every county in Ireland as we speak.
In terms of the scheme that's there now, one of the raison d'etre for your party's existence is your belief and the belief of your colleagues in 100% Redress that the current scheme is not fit for purpose. You've argued that, and you continue to articulate that on a regular basis in Dáil Éireann. Do you believe that what's coming down the line is going to make other existing TDs down the country actually look toward you and say, hang on a tick, perhaps this guy's right?
This has already happened as we speak. I'm constantly getting calls, and I'm meeting with TDs, government, opposition, down the country, that are dealing with their constituents that have defective concrete.
And in terms of the 100% Redress Party, you're now saying the party is looking to develop beyond Donegal and establish elsewhere, perhaps Mayo. We've a lot of talk about Mayo, obviously Limerick, in recent years, but you believe it's going to go far beyond that, and we could see a day where you have colleagues perhaps from other constituencies at the other end of the country.
Yeah, well, as I said, the unique point about the 100% Redress Party is we're a Donegal-born and bred party. The people of Donegal have taken the defective concrete fight and put it on blast to the point now where we have a party that's elected to represent people with defective concrete in Donegal. But as I've been saying before, the people in other counties need to stand up, prepare themselves and get ready for the fight like we've done in Donegal. And we are open to negotiating and talking about running candidates in other counties. But what we need from them is the same fight and commitment that the people of Donegal have shown. And the main priority for us is Donegal. But if people are willing to stand up and fight their corner, we'll support them in any way we can.
Interesting story on the front of the Derry News this morning with regards to the situation facing people from Derry, from Tyrone, from Fermanagh, who own holiday homes, perhaps in the Neshon, perhaps in the Downings area, Roscoil, in that whole Atlantic Drive, Fannet area, who have holiday homes, second homes that are affected by defective blocks, but they obviously can't get onto the scheme at the moment because it's not their primary residence. That's been described on a number of occasions as effectively a ticking time bomb that's waiting to explode. And that timer is getting ever shorter and shorter, it would appear.
Well, Donald, it's not just that. That's an interesting point you make there. But just to something I was listening earlier on, people in the north, we met with Derry and Strabane District Council, and we pointed out to them that not only is it their holiday homes of people from Northern Ireland that are affected, but it's also the fact is that the defective concrete is in Derry. And it's in Strabane, and you need to get yourselves ready for this, and you need to start putting down the blocks, as in, pardon the pun, but start building to get ready for what's coming down. They have a tsunami of building projects that are affected in Strabane and in Derry, and they're just not at the races when it comes to this defective block crisis. They don't realise that the effect. I said to them, basically, what in the chamber in Derry, you have the opportunity now to get yourselves ready, because what has visited us will be visiting you. Be ready.
It has also been raised on a number of occasions in the chamber at Stormont, but at the moment, it would appear on the face of it, the executive isn't treating this certainly with the level of seriousness and the level of priority that you believe it should be.
I believe Stormont has a responsibility. Stormont have a responsibility to their constituents. Basically, if you're in Derry and you're in Strabane and you have a defective concrete home, this has been allowed to happen. Much like the situation we have in the Republic, you now have defective concrete in Derry and Strabane. It needs to be legislated for. They need to have a will to fix these people's homes, because what will happen if they don't? Their homes will deteriorate to the point where they're facing homelessness. And currently, right now, as we speak, in Northern Ireland, they have a crisis going on when it comes to homelessness. And you do not want to not be ready for what's coming down the line. That's why I urged everybody in the council chamber in Derry to waken up to this and be ready to fight for your constituents, because if they've got defective homes, this is an all-Ireland problem, not just the Republic of Ireland. The six counties have it. It's the 32 counties that are affected, that will be affected with defective concrete, and we must be ready to fight and legislate and get a scheme in place for people in Northern Ireland.
It does beg a number of cross-border questions. Is the belief that homes in Derry and Strabane and elsewhere across Northern Ireland with defective concrete, is the belief that those homes were supplied with blocks from quarries and companies on this side of the border, or are there companies on the other side of the border as well that have been supplying blocks and products which are defective?
Well, you see, this is the key issue. Are we dealing with quarries that were supplying materials that then went into the Northern Ireland market? Or are we dealing with quarries in Northern Ireland that weren't checked for regulation and defective materials went on to us? We don't know until we start addressing the issue. Now, there's hundreds of people in Northern Ireland currently affected, in Strabane and Derry, that are currently affected. But it's also going beyond that. There's different counties in the six counties that are affected. They need to now start making inquiries and start the process of finding out what's going on. They're years behind currently where we are in Donegal, but my worry is that they sit back and don't have the will to imply a rigorous testing regime to make sure that this doesn't happen anywhere else. This is what we need. We need an all-Ireland regime of testing on quarries to make sure that this does not happen to the people again in Donegal. And you're dealing with defective materials here. And we've been dealing with this for 14 years. But it just seems that Donegal are the only ones that are ahead of the game when it comes to the defective concrete and getting that message out there.
You said earlier you've been speaking to politicians up and down the Republic. I mean, does that hold true? You've briefed, as you said, you've briefed Derry City and Strabane District Council. Are you speaking to political representatives elsewhere in Northern Ireland? Are you speaking to MLAs? Are you speaking to parties and independents?
Yeah, look, we're speaking to everybody. We've got an open dialogue going on here where people are coming, but they don't have the knowledge of what's actually going on. And as an elected representative, 100% redress party on defective concrete, I will inform them and try and steer them in the right direction to see if they do not react now and bring it forward in their own constituencies, then we will do it for them. Because if that's the case, people within these constituencies that are suffering from defective concrete, they're feeling abandoned, well, the 100% redress party will definitely get behind them and support them in any way we can.
There are obviously different political perspectives and different political arrangements north of the border. I take it the discussions you're having with political representatives are on all sides of the community and all sides of the political divide.
Effective concrete does not discriminate against. That's the thing. It doesn't matter who you are, what you are, or what you believe in. Defective concrete does not discriminate. So we do not discriminate. We are here to help everybody that we can. It's very important that that message is conveyed and that message is put out there. We are here to help you.
And you believe that members of the unionist community will row in behind any cross-border, any all-island initiative to try and get, as you say, a unified testing regime and a unified response? Because, as you say, defective concrete doesn't discriminate. The response can't discriminate either.
Yeah, of course. And what we're about is fixing people's homes and getting people to live their life and enjoy their life. You cannot be living your life in a defective home and be happy, because what is currently happening is we have people that are trapped in homes that can't sell them. They can't move on with their life. Their life is at a standstill. So we are representing these people. We're trying to get a scheme in place here, but also Northern Ireland now have to have the will and take responsibility and push forward on this. Because if they do not push forward, what starts off with 50 houses in Derry or 100 houses in Strabane will soon mushroom into something that is out of control. And with the way things are currently at the moment with the housing crisis, it's unacceptable to just sit back and allow this to happen. People need to get knowledge. They need to start writing and reading and talking about the defective concrete crisis in Northern Ireland.
Before we finish up, Charles, I want to talk to you briefly about the presidential election. Over the weekend, you made it clear, and to be honest, I would watch the Dáil regularly as part of my job in the newsroom. You sit beside Catherine Connolly. You regularly share time with Catherine Connolly. It's certainly no surprise that you're supporting Catherine Connolly in terms of the nomination for Uachtaráin na hÉireann.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, look, as I can say, Catherine has been an absolute star when it comes to helping myself adapt to life in Dublin. She has the experience, she has the integrity, she has the elegance, she's a seasoned politician, but more importantly, she's an independent voice who, doesn't matter where you are, opposition or in government, she has an independent voice, and I believe that is the voice that this country currently needs for us to push forward. We have government parties in charge of the Dáil and the Seanad, but for her, for president, to me, it's a no-brainer. She speaks the truth, and that's what this country currently needs. We need somebody in there that can be held accountable, but will also speak the truth and has an independent mind to what's currently going on.
Deputy Charles Ward, thank you very much indeed. Welcome back to the 9 till noon show here on Highland Radio. It's Donal with you until 12 noon, as the name suggests. Don't forget, you can WhatsApp us 086 60 25000. That number good for text messages as well. Call 074 91 25000. Email comments at highlandradio.com. We're Highland Hub on Facebook. We're at Highland Radio on Twitter or X. And we're on other social media platforms as well. You can watch the show unfold and indeed watch our studio guests live in studio as we speak as well on our YouTube channel, Highland Radio Ireland, and also on our Facebook pages. Now, delighted to say we're joined in studio by Nolene Devenny, who is the new manager of the Donegal Rape Crisis Centre. Nolene, a very good morning to you.
Thanks, Donal. Thanks for having me in.
It's our pleasure. A hugely important job. And you come to this job, Nolene, with experience in this area. Tell us something about yourself and your journey to this point where you're now managing the Rape Crisis Centre in Donegal.
I began in the Rape Crisis Centre as a volunteer about 5 years ago, and I was a volunteer for about a year and a half, and then I started to work as the SATU coordinator. SATU is the Sexual Assault and Treatment Unit. We offer psychological support in the SATU, Donal, to anyone who enters to have a forensic examination or anyone who's coming for a historical check. It's a privilege to work with the Rape Crisis Centre and work with the clients that come in through the door. I was SATU coordinator for a number of years, and then I retrained as a social worker, and I was able to take on the new role of the client support worker, which is particularly unique to the Rape Crisis Centre in Donegal. We offer advocacy, court support, which is really important for anyone attending court, because you know yourself, it can be quite terrifying when you walk in the doors of a courtroom. So we offer that psychological support and the moral support too.
And it's important too, because you're dealing with people who are hugely vulnerable. They've been through a hugely traumatic experience, and what you've almost got to do is prepare them to go into a situation where they're expected to be logical, they're expected to be clinical, they're expected to be factual, and they're expected to present a coherent statement of fact at a time when they themselves are probably completely scrambled and traumatised and in a state of shock, and to try and bridge that gap between what a court requires versus the support that they require. It's a difficult one, and I'm sure it takes a huge amount of skill and a huge amount of empathy to actually do that.
Yeah, it's quite an emotional time whenever you enter into the court stage of it. Now, not everyone goes to that part. Some people just come to our service to talk about what they've experienced, to share their story. But yeah, absolutely, whenever you go into the court, you're expected to be factual, you're expected to be a witness to your crime that was committed against you, and that in itself, that kind of separation where the judicial system requires you to separate yourself from your experience is incredibly traumatic and incredibly difficult. But yeah, I was saying, so a lot of our clients come in to the centre just to share their story, and I think that's really important for your listeners to know that, you know, we offer the support to all age groups from the age of 12 right up, and all genders. And we are primarily a counselling service, but we offer much more, and that is along the lines of the SATU support and the court support. But it's really important for people to know that they don't need to engage with the counselling service if they just wish to come to our service to have a conversation, to share their story, or to ask for some advice. You know, what do I do next? Where do I go? And it's not just for people who have experienced sexual violence recently. It is also for people who have experienced historical sexual violence. So whether that should be childhood sexual abuse or something that happened 10 years ago or something that happened 20 years ago. The thing about sexual violence is it's incredibly difficult to process.
Yeah.
The majority of the time what people want to do is they want to park it. They just want to say, I'm not dealing with that right now. The difficult aspect of that is trauma has a long-lasting impact and it doesn't go away. So whenever you experience sexual violence, it is always accompanied by trauma of some description, whether it's a small T, as Gabor Maté would say, or a big T. And that trauma can live in our bodies as well as in our behaviours. So whenever you experience sexual violence, it can have that impact then on your relationships going forward. It can have an impact on your career, you know, your employment prospects. We've had people who couldn't return to their jobs. We've had people who had to leave or go in for 1 hour a week because they were terrified of their perpetrator being nearby. So it's important that I would like to get that message out today, that we are there for everyone who wants to share their story, and you're not compelled to stay for six sessions or 10 sessions. If you just wish to come in, give us a call or you can email us and there's someone there to listen to you.
And I'm sure for someone who's experienced that as well, to actually trust other people must be a huge thing. I mean, I'll give you an example. I went to a show last night in the theatre as part of the Errigal Arts Festival. I went with a long-standing female friend. We met at the theatre. We warmly embraced. We had a chat. We went to the show. We had a chat afterwards. We embraced. We both went our separate ways home. And it was two friends meeting and having dialogue. I'm sure other people in that situation who've been through an experience, a traumatic experience of sexual assault, the next time they're meeting a male friend, is the embrace going to be as warm? Is the embrace going to be as trusting? Or is it going to be, oh no, a recoil, because it's going to bring that back? And I know it may sound trite, but it's to me it's a horrible thing to think that because of what someone has done to you, it may impact on the way you're going to react with other people who may not even have any idea of the experience that you went through elsewhere.
Yeah. So if we look at even the perpetrators of sexual violence, over 70% of them are known to us. And what it does is that it annihilates that trust. So on a fundamental basis as human beings, you and I can sit in this room and we trust each other that we're going to behave and that we will be able to have a conversation. What happens is when someone you know, whether it is a family member or if it is someone in your social group, when they cross that boundary, they break it. So what you're left with then is that you have this residual almost anxiety running through you. Is the next person going to do the same? Is my other friend going to be similar? Is my other family member going to... It changes your whole concept. Now, this isn't for across the board. You know, trauma has a very specific impact on everybody, you know, and it's very unique to that person. And it is all about, I suppose, your experience through life and what you've experienced in life. It can change our perspective, and it sometimes can change the perspective of those around us, our loved ones. So how they see us, you know, that can change. Mummies and daddies can be overprotective, you know. Brothers and sisters can be become distant because they don't know what to say. How do we handle this? And that's something that we can offer support with. We can support the mummies and the daddies. And it's not just the mummies and daddies. We get grannies and grandads and aunties. Families come in all shapes and sizes. So whoever is close to you, whoever is that important person, there's research out there to say that if you have one good, strong individual after you experience a trauma like sexual violence, that is the greatest predictor of a positive recovery.
And I'm sure people are coming to you and they're saying, what do I say?
Yeah.
What do I do? How do I show support? Because you're moving into a completely unknown area where people are going to be inevitably walking on eggshells. They want to say the right thing, and either one of two things will happen. Or either one of three things will happen. In an ideal scenario, you'll say the right thing. In the less ideal scenario, you'll potentially say the wrong thing. Or maybe the worst scenario of all, you'll almost say nothing, isolate the person, skip away from it, and almost not cross the road and avoid them, but avoid speaking about it and leave the person feeling even more isolated as a result.
Absolutely. It's that unknown that, you know, people don't know how to handle it. And our advice is always communication. And especially, I suppose, when we're talking about that parent-child relationship, you have maybe a mummy who wants to know, how are you doing? Every minute, because this terrible thing has happened to their child. Your child can be 18, 19, 20, 25, 30, but to you, your child never is an adult. You know, there's always that person that you love and want to protect, and you see them as, you know, that you're the protector for them. So this terrible thing has happened in their lives. And so you want to step in now and batten down the hatches, put up all the boundaries and say, we're staying in, I'm going to protect you. And that then can, for the person who's experienced the sexual violence, feel that they're being punished. So it's really important that open communication, that you can say to the person, I don't want to talk about it right now. Because for the majority of people who experience sexual violence recently, what they want to do is return to normality. They want to say, I'm just going to leave that for a wee second. Because when you experience sexual violence, it can be extremely overwhelming. The emotions that come with it, that you can barely touch them. Because once you even go near it, it is like an absolute vortex. So what they want to do is they want to leave it. The brain takes a long time to process what has happened, because what we want to do is we want to minimise it, because we don't want this terrible thing to exist. We don't want it to be real. So what they don't want to do is they don't want to talk about it afterwards. They don't want to have the conversation, and they don't want somebody saying, are you okay all the time? They want to return to their life. And that's okay. Whatever way it is that that person can cope. So for any parents or friends out there, is the key is to have an open conversation and say, I'm going to stop asking you. When you are upset or you feel the need that you want to talk to me or you want company, because human contact is really important. We don't have to be talking all the time. Just that physicality of being close to someone, watching a movie, going for a walk, it's so important. It reassures us of that trust, that bond that we have with each other. So even to do that and say, I'm not going to ask you anymore. If you want to come and talk to me, yeah. I'm here. I'm ready whenever you want to.
The big word at the moment, and rightly so, is consent.
Mm-hmm.
And our, as a society, it seems, our understanding of consent is evolving, and our expression and iteration of what consent is evolving. And it's interesting even to see a story on the front page of the Irish Times this morning that assumed consent is no longer going to be, mm-hmm. it seems, accepted as a defence in sexual assault cases. I'm sure that's something you are, or I won't put words in your mouth. Is that something you would welcome first off?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We cannot assume anything. When you're engaged, I think consent is really important. For what we have been trying to do for the past few years is we've been trying to reach the younger cohort. You know, we have a duty of care to protect our young people. We have a duty of care to make sure that they are making informed decisions in their lives. And they cannot make informed decisions unless they have the adequate information. If you think about how young people are being educated now, it is all on social media. It is all on technology. What they're not being educated on is what they have to do, how they have to behave, and what the parameters of that is. So what we have been doing is we've been going out into schools and we've been talking about consent. We don't have access to all of the schools. And what I'd like to ask today is if we have any secondary schools out there, we'll be approaching them all in September again, and we'll be looking to go into the schools and speak to even TY students. But it's really important. And there's also this, we are a diverse community in Donegal, and increasingly so, there is lots of new and different cultures coming into our county. And what I plan to do in the next few years is to have a cross-community worker where we can reach into the new communities and explain what the legislation in Ireland is around consent and make sure there's an understanding. Because we do have a duty of care to prevent and protect our young people. But yeah, this is absolutely welcome, because when you talk about consent, you can't assume what another person is thinking. You must have that understanding. And again, that's communication.
And so, I mean, just to, well, she didn't say no.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and maybe no was communicated in a look, in various different ways. But sort of when people say, well, she didn't say X or she didn't say Y. And the other difficult one, of course, is, and I suppose situations like this very often crop up on social occasions, perhaps late at night, perhaps there's been alcohol consumed, perhaps someone is a little bit tipsy, and that too brings its own dimension, that sometimes people are not necessarily in a position to give consent because they're, I don't want to say impaired, but I don't know what the right word is, but perhaps after a few drinks you're not in as clear a position to give, and I hope I'm not phrasing this wrongly, but you know, after a couple of drinks, after a good night out, maybe you're not in a position to give consent, and maybe that needs to be taught. You know that, you know, if you're out with someone and they're tipsy, maybe, you know, you can't assume consent because they're not necessarily in a position to give it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I talked about this before, and it's not always very romantic or, you know, in the heat of the moment to have that conversation. But it is about being able to discuss it or read the body language. You know, 90% of our communication is body language. It's our facial expressions. It's our posture, how we hold ourselves and how we present. So being aware of that and also being respectful. That's what this boils down to, really, Donal, is about respect for each other. We talk about perpetrators. We talk about people who, what is their motivation behind this, you know, to perpetrate these crimes. It's all about the lack of respect and the lack of morality, you know, that as human beings, we should have respect for each other's choices and we should respect the decisions that they're making.
The number of sex offenders in prisons in this country has increased by 16% in the past year. And in Donegal, reported incidents between 2003 and 2024 have risen by 66%. Now, that can mean either one of two things. That can either mean what has always been happening is happening and it's just being reported and detected more, or it can mean there is an increase in what's happening. Where do you see that? I mean, is there any way, can we say this shows that there is more detection, or does it show there is actually more incidence of sexual violence?
So we know that things don't happen in isolation, so there could be both things together. We have the establishment of the DPSU in Donegal, and it's been here 5 years now. So it could be the fact that, you know, that because they're a specialised unit, that they are being able to prosecute more people. But it could also be that there is a higher rate now in Donegal. Yeah. And we have to, as a community, look at porn and the influence of porn in the behaviour. Our young people are being educated in sexual relationships through porn. And it is very skewed. The understanding of people who are engaging in sexual activity together and what they agree on at the beginning and what that other person decides to do is becoming very different. And that is based on what they're viewing. And if we look at that and moving forward, how that's going to impact our young people, we have a duty of care to look at that and say, you know, we need to be stepping in here. We need to make sure that their education is appropriate. But yeah, so it could be just a combination of both. We're part of the SART group, which is the Sexual Assault Response Team. That's ourselves, DPSU, Domestic Violence Services are involved, SATU, as well as TISLA and HSE. And part of maybe the reason for the high conviction rates and is the high reporting rate, and it could be that our presence in the county is felt more, that we're out now and we're working with community organisations and we are getting into some schools as well, so people are recognising what the experience is wrong, because that can sometimes be a question where people say, oh, it feels wrong, I'm not too sure if it is wrong. But if you're in doubt, that's whenever you can contact us and ask that question. So yeah, I think it's a combination of both.
Nolene, it's been a pleasure speaking to you, and thank you indeed for coming in and speaking to us this morning. It's really important that people know that those services are there, and we'll put details up on our own social media pages and our Facebook pages and so on. For the moment, Nolene Devaney, I just got a call, by the way, a person just rang to say you've got a beautifully soothing voice. And no, which is a very good one. I absolutely see where that caller is coming from, that your voice is, there's a lovely soothing quality to it, but there's also a trusting quality to it that is going to serve you well, I think, and has, I'm sure, served you well over the past 13 plus years of your involvement in terms of counselling and in terms of volunteering and in SATU and so on and so forth. I'm sure that will continue, but for the moment, Nolene Devaney, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks so much, Donal.
I did find myself awake at about 3 o'clock this morning, and I have to say, we'd left the window open because it was quite muggy, and the rain was making such a racket outside. It was like, oh, I am glad I am nicely wrapped up and I am not out. Well, I wasn't wrapped up, I was lying on top of the duvet because it was too bloody warm, but I was so glad I was not out in that. It really, really was heavy. Now, I want to take a few birthday requests and one or two comments before we go for a break and for news. Please wish Mary McKeever of Castle Shanahan, Letterkenny, a very happy birthday today from Danny and Katrina. Have a great day, Mary. Happy birthday to you. And also a very special birthday request for wee Jamie Friel, who is 6 today, and that's from Nanny and Grandad. Jamie, a very happy birthday to you. I hope you're having a great summer. Just one or two comments with regards to the discussion earlier about blocking off the lifeboat station. The fact that no Gardaí notice a lifeboat station being blocked is indicative of the lack of policing at the moment. Surely on a hot day, Gardaí will be patrolling areas where crowds or swimmers would be expected to be. I don't think we can say Gardaí weren't aware of it. It may well be that Gardaí were monitoring the situation. I wouldn't be making that presumption. But the point certainly is taken. Why is the area not cordoned off for access for lifeboats so no cars can park there? It's not cordoned off because the lifeboat needs to be got out of the building and down into the water very, very quickly. If you start erecting fences and gates and things like that, you're adding in, as Killian from the lifeboat said to us earlier, you are literally looking at something that they want to take 10 minutes to get from the couch to the lifeboat. So every second counts in this. So if they start putting up fences and putting up gates, that's going to add to the delays, I would have thought. One or two other comments before we go for a break in for news. Question, the GAA would have made millions on tickets between Saturday and Sunday, and again on the final. Where does this money go? It doesn't go to players or clubs that I'm aware of, so how is this money spent? I'm sure that Croke Park money is spent on a myriad of things, not least paying for Croke Park. And these cars should be towed away and defined to get them back. So many people nowadays think only of themselves with no respect for anything.